Chapter 2, The Motives of Devotion. Sri Aurobindo continued his series on the Yoga of Divine Love, as we call it, in this issue, which appeared in the Arya on the 15th of May, 1918. Unretouched since then, it stands now, it was written then. So in the first essay in the series, Love and the Triple Path, he laid out what the three methods by which the elements of our being can seek reunification with the divine through work, through knowledge, through love. He rather continues this theme here, increasingly focusing on bhakti. And what are the first urges that draw us towards the Supreme, rising from our nature? So we begin. The motives of devotion. All religion begins with the conception of some power or existence greater and higher than our limited and mortal selves. A thought and act of worship done to that power, and an obedience offered to its will, its laws, or its demands. But religion, in its beginnings, sets an immeasurable gulf between the power thus conceived, worshipped, and obeyed, and the worshipper. This gulf, of course, is very much a part of theistic religions, which see the divine reality, that person, as something august and supreme, and we, bereft of real reality, small and transient, erring in our action, ignorant in our conception, could not but look at that with wonder from a great distance. We'll come back to that shortly. Of course, the classic I and thou. Yoga, in its culmination, abolishes the gulf. For yoga is union. The Indian genius is to unify. Where exoteric Western-based religions rarely touch upon the idea of the mystical closure of that gap between soul and divine, India insists upon capturing it again and again through all the modes of our being to arrive at oneness, to live in identity with that. So he continues, we arrive at union with it through knowledge. For as our first obscure conceptions of it clarify, enlarge, deepen, we come to recognize it as our own highest self, the origin and sustainer of our being, and that towards which it tends. We arrive at union with it through works. For from simply obeying, we come to identify our will with its will, since only in proportion as it is identified with this power that is its source and ideal, can our will become perfect and divine. We arrive at union with it also by worship. For the thought and act of a distant worship develops into the necessity of close adoration, and this into the intimacy of love. And the consummation of love is union with the beloved. It is from this development of worship that the yoga of devotion starts. And it is by this union with the beloved that it finds its highest point and consummation. Worship, which is a word from Old English, which speaks to worth, the worth of oneself in offering to that which is of greater value, to adore, to honor in English. Modern English is what it would mean. To worship is not simply an external act. It is a movement from the small to the large, from the near to the far. All our instincts and the movements of our being begin by supporting themselves on the ordinary motives of our lower human nature, mixed and egoistic motives at first, but afterwards they purify and elevate themselves. They become an intense and special need of our higher nature, quite apart from the results our actions bring with them. Finally, they exalt themselves into a sort of categorical imperative of our being, and it is through our obedience to this that we arrive at that supreme something self-existent in us, which was all the time drawing us towards it. First, by the lures of our egoistic nature, then by something much higher, larger, more universal, until we are able to feel its own direct attraction, which is the strongest and most imperative of all. In the transformation of ordinary religious worship into the yoga of pure bhakti, we see this development from the motived and interested worship of popular religion into a principle of motiveless and self-existent love. This last is in fact the touchstone of the real bhakti and shows whether we are really in the central way or are only upon one of the bypaths leading to it. We have to throw away the props of our weakness, the motives of the ego, the lures of our lower nature before we can deserve the divine union. Worth, worship, to become worthy by offering, by acknowledging, by recognizing. Note that Sri Aurobindo in this passage says, we arrive at that supreme something self-existent in us. It is not simply that it is there, not here. Remember, Sri Aurobindo is steeped in the Gita. And the teaching of the Gita is that the Supreme Person, Purushottama, from his higher nature, Para-Prakriti, generates countless numbers of soul sparks, each which contain that essential nature in themselves. So, that lies at the base. And for us to become attached to that, to participate, to take a share in that portion, means to recover our own selves in union with that. So love closes the distance. Narada Bhakti Sutras begin in their first verse. It's actually verse 2. Bhakti is supreme love. Parama prema. And it goes to the next verse to say, and that is immortality. Experiencing this supreme love makes you immortal and gives you fulfillment. When that is found, when that is established, when you commune with that supreme person in this great act of love, utter self-giving, and complete receiving, there is no dearth, there is no want, there is no darkness, there is only felicity and delight. So discarding the integuments of the past, the limitations of apparent nature, allows us to secure our being essentially in that. That is where we recover our immortality. Is that all? Do we then leave the universe? We'll see that Sri Aurobindo, even in the ways of love, insists that we pour out the bliss, the rhapsody of that oneness in a multiple experience, expressed in knowledge, expressed in the dynamics of work. Back to his essay. Faced with the sense of a power, or perhaps a number of powers greater and higher than himself, by whom his life and nature is overshadowed, influenced, governed, man naturally applies to it or to them the first primitive feelings of the natural being among the difficulties, desires, and dangers of that life, fear and interest. The enormous part played by these motives in the evolution of the religious instinct is undeniable. And in fact, man being what he is, it could hardly have been less. And even when religion has advanced fairly far on its road, we see these motives still surviving, active, playing a sufficiently large part, justified and appealed to by religion herself in support of her claims on man. So, be fearful of this wrathful God. Give generously and something will come back to you. The fear of God, it is said, or it may be added for the sake of historical truth, the fear of the gods is the beginning of religion, a half-truth upon which scientific research trying to trace the evolution of religion, ordinarily in a critical and often a hostile rather than in a sympathetic spirit, has laid undue emphasis. But not the fear of God only, for man does not act, even most primitively, from fear alone, but from twin motives, fear and desire. Fear of things unpleasant and maleficent, and desire of things pleasant and beneficent, therefore, from fear and interest. Well, we see this in the Gita also. Krishna, counseling Arjuna, says in chapter 4, shloka 12, they who desire the fulfillment of their works on earth sacrifice to the gods, for the fulfillment born of works is swift and easy. Hinting to Arjuna that there are greater rewards, there are greater delights. And in fact, just a few shlokas later, shloka 25, some yogins follow the sacrifice of the gods. Others offer the sacrifice by the sacrifice itself into the Brahman fire. So they use the method of self-giving to grow into oneness with that fiery essence of what is Brahman, the ever-developing, the ever-enlarging divine reality. Life to him is primarily and engrossingly, until he learns to live more in his soul and only secondarily in the action and reaction of outward things, a series of actions and results, things to be desired, pursued, and gained by action, and things to be dreaded and shunned, yet which may come upon him as a result of action. And it is not only by his own action, but by that also of others and of nature around him, that these things come to him. As soon then as he comes to sense a power behind all this, which can influence or determine action and result, he conceives of it as a dispenser of boons and sufferings, able and under certain conditions, willing to help him or hurt, save and destroy. So, sensing the power behind is a growth out of ignorance, leaving the gross for the subtler. One may not know, but one has a hint that there is a reality. Insensible to the touch, but sensible to the awakening consciousness. And one seeks some alignment of the being with that. In the most primitive parts of his being, he conceives of it as a thing of natural egoistic impulses like himself. Beneficent when pleased, maleficent when offended. Worship is then a means of propitiation by gifts and a supplication by prayer. He gets God on his side by praying to him and flattering him. This is the anthropomorphic being that humanity worships. He's like us. He's mad all the time. He's looking for a reason to criticize. He loves to punish. He will occasionally bless and give bounty. With a more advanced mentality, he conceives of the action of life as reposing on a certain principle of divine justice, which he reads always according to his own ideas and character, as a sort of enlarged copy of his human justice. He conceives the idea of moral good and evil and looks upon suffering and calamity and all things unpleasant as a punishment for his sins and upon happiness and good fortune and all things pleasant as a reward of his virtue. In other words, he's going to construct his own moral system. God appears to him as a king, judge, legislator, executor of justice, but still regarding him as a sort of magnified man, he imagines that as his own justice can be deflected by prayers and propitiation. So the divine justice can also be deflected by the same means. Reversing the order, as below, so above. Justice is to him reward and punishment. And the justice of punishment can be modified by mercy to the suppliant, while rewards can be supplemented by special favors and kindness, such as power, when pleased, can always bestow on its adherents and worshippers. So very like the human king. Moreover, God, like ourselves, is capable of wrath and revenge, and wrath and revenge can be turned by gifts and supplication and atonement. He is capable, too, of partiality, and his partiality can be attracted by gifts, by prayer, and by praise. Therefore, instead of relying solely on the observation of the moral law, worship as prayer and propitiation is still continued. It's a means of suspending the law of the universe. Along with these motives, there arises another development of personal feeling, first of the awe which one naturally feels for something vast, powerful, and incalculable beyond our nature by a certain inscrutability in the springs and extent of its action, and of the veneration and adoration which one feels for that which is higher in its nature or its perfection than ourselves. Students of religion will recognize this as the experience of the divine as the numinous, as something vast, and the human as something immeasurably small. And what one feels is awe. It is truly an awful experience, because one is timorous and shivering and small by comparison with that. And this is one of the great experiences, bringing the human out of dull servitude to the round of material nature. One becomes aware of that, and typically of the gulf between. It isn't yet time to speak of the mystical experience. But however large and small we may be in the numinous, in the mystical we become one with. There is identity. There is merger. There is the closing of the gulf. He continues, for even while preserving largely the idea of a God endowed with the qualities of human nature, there still grows up along with it, mixed up with it, or superadded, the conception of an omniscience, an omnipotence, and a mysterious perfection quite other than our nature. A confused mixture of all these motives, variously developed, often modified, subtilized, or glossed over, is what constitutes 9/10 of popular religion. The other 10th is a suffusion of the rest by the percolation into it of nobler, more beautiful, and profounder ideas of the divine, which minds of a greater spirituality have been able to bring into the more primitive religious concepts of mankind. The result is usually crude enough and a ready target for the shafts of skepticism and unbelief, powers of the human mind which have their utility even for faith and religion, since they compel a religion to purify gradually what is crude or false in its conceptions. But what we have to see is how far in purifying and elevating the religious instinct of worship any of these earlier motives need to survive and enter into the yoga of devotion, which itself starts from worship. So we're back to the idea of purification, of elevation, of leaving this dross behind and getting to the more beautiful parts of our own nobler soul nature. That depends on how far they correspond to any truth of the divine being and its relations with the human soul. For we seek, by bhakti, union with the divine and true relation with its truth, and not with any mirage of our lower nature and of its egoistic impulses and ignorant conceptions. He uses the term divine here, because typically in India, if we've been studying religion, we think immediately of Shaivism and Vaishnavism, two of the great branches of the pursuit of divine love. But there is also the devotional path of Shaktism, the worship of the Divine Mother, another major current which is as old as these paths of Shaivism and Vaishnavism. Continuing, the ground on which skeptical unbelief assails religion, namely, that there is in fact no conscient power or being in the universe greater and higher than ourselves, or in any way influencing or controlling our existence, is one which yoga cannot accept, as that would contradict all spiritual experience and make yoga itself impossible. Yoga is not a matter of theory or dogma, like philosophy or popular religion, but a matter of experience. Sri Aurobindo insists on this. And while an equivalent for the exact English term experience is not found in the Upanishads, one finds often in the Upanishads that the sages speak directly of their experience of reality. And they can speak about it because they have entered into identification with it. They know it by identity. So it is in the Kena. So it is in earlier Upanishads, like the Brihadaranyaka, like the Chandogya. Certainly it is true in Katha, Shvetashvatara, Mundaka, and the list goes on and on. So the idea that one can experience the great reality, whether seen as an impersonality or seen as a person, or left undescribed because language cannot capture that. Still, the experience is real, and Sri Aurobindo's entire philosophy of the life divine is founded upon the veridical nature of experience. That it is true, that one can enter into meaningful connection to and deepen that connection into identity. And that is the process of yoga. Processive, but also arriving at a state which is unshakably secure, where yoga is faultless and permanent. Yoga is union. Its experience is that of a conscient, universal, and supra-cosmic being with whom it brings us into union, and this conscious experience of union with the invisible, always renewable and verifiable, is as valid as our conscious experience of a physical world and of visible bodies with whose invisible minds we daily communicate. Huh. So we refer to the inwardness of our experience and know that our thoughts are real, even though we cannot objectify them or measure them. only their correlates as they dance along nerve pathways in brain science. It's not the same thing. That inner world exists and is tangible to the growing spiritual consciousness. So here, again, an echo from the Gita, chapter 7, shloka 23. To the gods go the worshippers of the gods. My devotees come to me. Yoga proceeds by conscious union. The conscious being is its instrument, and a conscious union with the inconscient cannot be. It is true that it goes beyond the human consciousness and in samadhi becomes superconscient, but this is not an annihilation of our conscious being. It is only its self-exceeding, the going beyond its present level and normal limits. This is not the self-canceling. This is the self-completing. One becomes awake in oneness and in shared essence and in communion, the sharing of the nature. So far, then, all yogic experience is agreed. But religion and the yoga of bhakti go farther. They attribute to this being a personality and human relations with the human being. Purushottama, standing as Krishna, enters into deep and meaningful and profound relationship with his disciple, Arjuna. In both, the human being approaches the divine by means of his humanity, with human emotions, as he would approach a fellow being, but with more intense and exalted feelings. And not only so, but the divine also responds in a manner answering to these emotions. So again, from the near to the far, and from the far to the near, you take one step towards the divine takes two steps towards you. In that possibility of response lies the whole question. For if the divine is impersonal, featureless, and relationless, no such response is possible, and all human approach to it becomes an absurdity. We must rather dehumanize, depersonalize, annul ourselves insofar as we are human beings or any kind of beings. On no other conditions and by no other means can we approach it. Love, fear, prayer, praise, worship of an impersonality which has no relation with us or with anything in the universe and no feature that our minds can lay hold of are obviously an irrational foolishness. On such terms, religion and devotion become out of the question. The Advaitin, in order to find a religious basis for his bare and sterile philosophy, has to admit the practical existence of God and the gods and to delude his mind with the language of Maya. Buddhism only became a popular religion when Buddha had taken the place of the supreme deity as an object of worship. For Sri Aurobindo, these are ironic and playful sentences because remember, he began with the experience of Brahmic Nirvana, the canceling out of his ego, annihilation of all sense of self, merger of himself into this abstract reality, full, conscious, but without personality. And that was an experience that he lived in continually. It was a realization which he had almost instantaneously, which was completed and in some senses overarched A few months later, when in the Alipur jail, he came to know the omnipresent personality of the divine, whom he called Vasudeva, Krishna. Just a name, just a figure, but a person with a capital P, in whom he found his own truth of being. So, when you have that experience, which engulfs the engulfing experience of nirvana, you can see that he can not abide with his idea that this Godhead, so tangible and real to him, is farcical. No, it is complete. So we'll continue with the balance of the chapter next time. We'll put a bookmark there, and we'll leave Shankara's Advaita and go forward in the yoga of divine love. Perhaps not next week, but the week after, because next week is the 15th of August, and I am likely to speak on the subject of Sri Aurobindo and his integral yoga. And we'll take up the thread of this chapter on the 22nd, with your permission. This is a section I'll read to you now from Savitri in Book 2, the Book of the Traveler of the Worlds, in Canto 11, Kingdoms and Godheads of the Greater Mind. We'll begin on page 264. This will bring the earlier section of this chapter back to mind for you. A triple realm of ordered thought came first, a small beginning of immense ascent. Above were bright ethereal skies of mind, a packed and endless soar, as if sky-pressed sky, buttressed against the void on bastioned light. The highest strove to neighbor eternity, the largest widened into the infinite. But though immortal, mighty and divine, the first realms were close and kin to human mind. Their deities shape our greater thinking's roads. A fragment of their puissance can be ours. These breadths were not too broad for our souls to range. These heights were not too high for human hope. A triple flight led to this triple world. Although abrupt for common strengths to tread, its upward slope looks down on our earth poise. On a slant not too precipitously steep, one could turn back, traveling deep descending lines to commune with the mortal's universe. The mighty wardens of the ascending stair, who intercede with the all-creating word, there waited for the pilgrim heaven-bound soul. Holding the thousand keys of the beyond, they proffered their knowledge to the climbing mind and filled the life with thought's immensities. The prophet hierophants of the occult law, the flame-bright hierarchs of the divine truth, interpreters between man's mind and God's, they bring the immortal fire to mortal men. Iridescent, bodying the invisible, the guardians of the eternal's bright degrees fronted the sun in radiant phalanxes. Afar, they seemed a symbol imagery, illumined originals of the shadowy script in which our sight transcribes the ideal ray, or icons figuring a mystic truth, but nearer, gods and living presences. A march of friezes marked the lowest steps. Fantastically ornate and richly small, they had room for the whole meaning of a world, symbols minute of its perfection's joy, strange beasts that were nature's forces made alive and wakened to the wonder of his role, man grown an image undefaced of God, and objects the fine coin of beauty's reign. But wide the terrains were those levels serve, in front of the ascending epiphany, world time's enjoyers, favorites of world bliss, the masters of things actual, lords of the hours, playmates of youthful nature and child God, creators of matter by hid stress of mind, whose subtle thoughts support unconscious life and guide the fantasy of brute events, stood there, a race of young, keen-visioned gods, king children born on wisdom's early plain. Taught in her school world-making's mystic play, archmasons of the eternal thaumaturge, molders and measurers of fragmented space, they have made their plan of the concealed and known a dwelling house for the invisible king. Obeying the eternal's deep command, they have built in the material front of things this wide world kindergarten of young souls, where the infant spirit learns through mind and sense to read the letters of the cosmic script and study the body of the cosmic self and search for the secret meaning of the whole. To all that spirit conceives, they give a mold, persuading nature into visible moods. They lend a finite shape to infinite things. Each power that leaps from the unmanifest, leaving the largeness of the eternal's peace, they seized and held by their precision eye and made a figurante in the cosmic dance. Dance away then. We'll see you next time. Namaste, Jai Ma.